Return to a place where you have lectured before. It's particularly pleasing to know that there are people who will come to hear you when they don't have to. When I was lecturing at Chicago, I usually had pretty good sized attendance, but after all, the students were held responsible for what I said, and I was not always sure that although we did not have compulsory attendance, I was not sure that the attendance was to do so much to what they wanted to hear as to what they had to hear. I've been asked to talk tonight on a subject very different from the one in which I discussed last year. Last year I tried in an hour's time to crowd a lot of information together which would serve as a background for the understanding of conditions in Southeast Asia. Tonight, the subject is quite different. I think it's quite as important, perhaps as immediate in its need. I've been asked to talk on the subject of prejudice. An anthropologist surveys our prejudices. But surely Dr. McGregor and the others responsible must have been thinking of this in an editorial sense. Surely it was not meant for us here in America. Or surely it was not meant for those of us gathered here on the campus of a great university. Can it be that we do have prejudices? Well, perhaps before I go any further, I should define my meaning of prejudice. When I looked it up in a dictionary, I didn't find, or at least I didn't like the definition I found, so I tried one of my own. There was a time when I had a great deal of respect for Webster and his dictionary and for the encyclopedias. And then I began to write for the encyclopedias. And then later, I was on the editorial board of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And what we did to that encyclopedia, by the way of revision, well, at any rate, I'm not quite so confident of the definitions even in Webster. And so I tried one of my own. And this I give you at least for the definition of prejudice as I shall use it this evening. I have defined it as a judgment arrived at without sufficient thought or knowledge and held without reasonable grounds. Now I repeat that. A judgment arrived at without sufficient thought or knowledge and held without reasonable grounds. In general, I think that prejudice seems to start with a lack of knowledge and is intensified by differences in physical type, in dress, in language, in custom, religion, and in economic status. Those of you who have read the very interesting book by Barton called The Halfway Son will remember a very interesting example which fits very closely into our picture. Dr. Barton was writing of a people known as the Ifugao, one of the wildest of the head-hunting tribes of the northern Philippine Islands. These people occupy an extremely rugged mountain territory, the sides of which they have terraced one step after another up the mountainsides to make way for their rice fields. They build their villages and little hamlets in the most inaccessible spot and on the most worthless ground, because in this way they are protected against the raids of their enemies. These people have a series of zones. The people who live in your little settlement, in your little hamlet, are quite all right. They are your relatives. They speak the same dialect that you do. They have the same beliefs, the same customs. They're just like those of our own family. In that zone, no heads are taken. And then around this immediate zone is a friendly zone. And in that, no heads are taken, because you intermarry a great deal and you have many friends in that group. They're almost like you. You understand their dialect very readily. They are so much like you that, of course, you wouldn't think of taking heads. Then comes the next zone, is the feuding zone. And these people are not quite so good. An occasional head is taken there, but still there has to be a good deal of provocation, because you do intermarry to a certain extent there, and the people are not so different. But beyond this feuding zone, everything is fair game. Dr. Barton tells of going with taking a young Ifugao warrior out into this outer zone to a meeting that had been called by an American governor. And this young warrior took hold of Barton and shook his arm, and he said, "Apo, before the Americans came here, our people came out into this territory and would lie in ambush. And if they saw a man wearing a back basket like that fellow's, they'd kill him. Why should you wear such an outfit? He's hardly a man. He must be some kind of a monkey. Just look at the pattern of his G-string." In the Philippine Islands, in the wild country, practically everyone who lives at a distance with whom you are not familiar is known as Kalinga, enemy. In other words, if you are at a distance and you don't understand, you don't know, these people are Kalinga. As we were pushing back into the interior of the Philippines, we would be told about the terrible Kalinga, and they were always about three towns away. The first towns were all right, but the bad people were always quite a ways ahead, or when you got up in here, they were behind you, and people wondered how you got through. Now these are beliefs. People who are strange are in some way dangerous, and the people of our own group are always the best. For instance, around the people of northern North America, the people we call, know ordinarily as Eskimo, so-called by their neighbors because the term means eaters of raw meat, these people do not use the term for themselves at all. They use the term Inuit, which means we, the people. We worked for 16 months with a headhunting tribe in the northern Philippines, known to the coast people as Tingyan, or dwellers in the high mountains. They never use the term for themselves. They call themselves Itneg, we, the people. Now these are beliefs. We and our kind are all right. All that is strange is bizarre or dangerous. But we also have prejudices of a different kind. We have prejudices that are the result of education, of propaganda. I think probably every student of anthropology is familiar with a book that came out a few years ago by a man by the name of Madison Grant called The Passing of the Great Race. And what Madison Grant was attempting to do was to show that the Nordics, the people of Northern Europe, were responsible for everything worthwhile that had happened in civilization. They were the finest, the most advanced physical type. They had the best shaped heads, indicating the best type of brain, and indicated that everything worthwhile had come as a result of the Nordics or Nordic infusions. He even went so far as to say that Christ must have been a Nordic because of his teachings and because of his accomplishments. Now, he completely ignored the fact that even if he'd taken his own evidence, that had he been really hunting for what had been accomplished by the Nordics, he would have had some difficulty. Shortly after this book appeared, I gave to a class in introductory anthropology in a quiz, I asked them to state that all of the accomplishments and all the development towards civilization made by the people of Northern Europe prior to 1500. I wish you could have seen the papers. Or, if you want to know what they wrote, try it yourself. You'll come out, I think, with very little to be said. You'll find that they were good organizers, they were good fighters, but when it came to the accomplishments, the development towards civilization, the people of Northern Europe were very laggard until very late times. Then they suddenly burst all bounds and became world leaders. But had Madison Grant followed his own argument, he probably would have had to be given the palm to the people of the Mediterranean race, with a good bit of credit to the Alpines, both of whom were low in his list. I don't need to remind anyone in this group of the teachings of Hitler and his followers, in which he taught of an Aryan super race. I'm sure Hitler would like to have said Nordic, but it was very clear that Hitler physically was not a Nordic. He was very definitely something else, largely Alpine, with the result that it became the Aryan super race. And you remember that he went so far, and his followers, in their teachings, that they came to the dictum, Right is what area men deem right. And you know the result. The number of people who believed it, who were taken in by this, at least in Germany, were very numerous. But perhaps our chief prejudices do center around this subject of race, because here the special pleader has very great influence. Now, this is due partially to propaganda. It's due partially to misunderstanding. Because the term is used so variously, it is used so without thought, that I think we ought to examine it for a moment. Because under the heading of race, we have many leads towards intolerance and hatred. The word race is, as I say, is used very loosely, even by many of our leading authorities. Some time back, a leading magazine, usually noted for the care with which their articles are selected, published an article called Let Race Alone. And I don't think there was any doubt as to the good intentions of the writer. In this article, the writer wrote of a French race, an Aryan race, and a Jewish race. And he was wrong on every count. There is no French race. France is a nationality, and its unity lies in its nationalism and in its language and a common tradition. There is no Aryan race, in spite of Hitler and his teachings. The people who speak Aryan languages are known as Aryans. And this takes in the Russians and the Germans and the English and the French and the Italians and to the North Indians and, strangely enough, some of the most primitive people on the face of the earth, the Rat Veda of Ceylon. If you were to keep the Aryan race pure, as was the Hitler plea, you would start with the Russians and you'd end with the Rat Veda. And there is no Jewish race. And here perhaps I better take just a moment, because if I don't, it will come back to me in questions a little bit later. The evidence at hand seems to indicate that the Jewish people, early Jewish people, were predominantly of Mediterranean race. After their dispersal, many of them spread along the coast of North Africa, and it is a matter of history that they converted very large groups of Berbers to the Jewish faith, and these became known as Jews. This had nothing to do with the racial question, because they were a Mediterranean race, like the greater portion of the early Jewish people. Many of the Jewish people spread northward, and were well received, and finally they came into the region between the Black Sea from the Aral-Caspian north and between the Black Sea and along the Danube. And there they found a very powerful mid-Russian empire, the Empire of the Khazars. These people were of Alpine race. They succeeded in making great headway with the ruling group. And I believe it was in the year 830 A.D. that they succeeded in converting the leaders of this group to Judaism. And soon the people became known as followers of the Jewish faith. About a century later, with the incursion of other peoples from the east, the Slavic-speaking peoples, the empire of the Khazars was broken, and these people were scattered all over Central Europe as Jews. Now, they were Jews in faith, they were Jews in tradition, and Jews in suffering the intolerance of that period. But they were of different race than the original Jews. In other words, the term race has been used very roughly here and without any particular sense. Or take another case. The National Geographic Society, some time back, put out a map which they called a new racial map of Europe. And it didn't have anything to do with race. It was a new national map of Europe. And yet, on such misunderstandings, such loose use of the terms, even by people who should know better, we legislate. Many states have had laws about racial intermixture, intermarriage. Also, even the question of nationalization comes up on the subject of race. A young Arab came into my office some time ago, said that he was an Arabian born in Jerusalem, that he had applied to the immigration authorities in the city of Chicago for naturalization, and after consideration, it had been refused, because he was neither a Negro or a freeborn white, those who are allowed to be naturalized. He asked what then he was, and they told him that he was a member of the brown race. He asked what that meant, and they didn't know. So he came out to the university, and we went over the gentleman from the physical standpoint and pronounced him a perfectly good Mediterranean. On that basis, the Arab League appealed to the immigration authorities, and the Supreme Court decided in favor of the Arabs. And now they are perfectly good Caucasians and can be admitted to the I don't know how many times the Automobile Club has called me up and asked me if, for instance, if an Armenian was a Caucasian. If he was, he could join the Automobile Club. Special pleaders have made a great deal of this subject of superior and inferior races. A great deal has been said about Negro inferiority, and explanations have been given. Some special pleaders, for instance, with some show of scientific authority, have said that the sutures of the skull of the Negro close earlier than in the case of the whites. The sutures, as you know, are the lines where the various bones of the head meet each other, along the crown of the head, along the center, and at the back. And it was said that the Negro child was just as keen, just as bright as the white child, up to a certain point, and then he began to lag. And it was said that the reason for this was that the sutures be closed earlier, that the brain could no longer expand, and that you had a retarded mentality. And it was also said that the Negro had a more infantile physical type because the epiphyses, the caps on the long bones, closed at an earlier stage and that growth was retarded. Well, a long series of studies made by Dr. Wingate Todd at Western Reserve and by others, and the unknown individuals of known ages, on skeletons of known individuals and of known ages, and a great deal of use was done with work was done with the X-ray, and it has been shown without any question of a doubt that the sutures on the Negro skull do not close any earlier than on any other group of people, and that the epiphyses or caps of the long bones do not close any earlier. If a Negro child in our society begins to be retarded at the age of 10 or 12, or perhaps a little earlier, perhaps that is the time when he begins to feel social pressure, and he begins to realize that he is somewhat different. But not all of this argument of superior and inferior people is against the Negro or against the yellow man. I've mentioned the writings of Madison Grant. I've mentioned the situation in Germany. But we have not been immune from education to hate and education for intolerance, even in this country. We have said a great deal about the education of the population of Germany and other countries towards intolerance. It occurs in our own country. During the war, an eminent physician in the city of Chicago wrote a book called Round Heads or Long Heads or What's the Matter with Germany? And he showed that the Germans were what they were. They just couldn't help being because they were round-headed. They were Huns, they were savages. It was something that was innate. Of course, the chief difficulty came here, as was soon shown by Dr. Hooten and some of the others, was that not quite half of the German population could have possibly be classed in this group, because there were more long heads than there were round heads in Germany. What this doctor had done was to make a pretty bad case against a country which we think very well of, that is the Swiss, or against the Italians, but certainly not against the people for whom he was at the moment preaching. We hear a great deal in pseudo-scientific articles, such as the question of Jewish blood. And of course, the Jewish people have the same blood characteristics as the surrounding non-Jewish population. And then we read learned articles telling us that race mixture is bad. And yet, probably before you get through that article, you will read that the reason that the mulatto has achieved as he has is because of white blood. A very eminent Scandinavian scientist put out a series of papers a few years ago dealing with race mixture. This was, I don't know how you pronounce the name, it's spelled M-J-O-E-M, with an umlaut. This gentleman wrote an article, first of all, based on animal experimentation, in which he showed that race mixture of diverse races was equivalent to race suicide. For he said, in the fifth and succeeding generations, the animals are sterile, and believed that the same would apply to humans. Dr. Castle of Johns Hopkins took up the same study with the same group of animals and showed, under carefully controlled conditions, that the fifth and succeeding generations were just as fertile, if not slightly more fertile, than the parent generation, and laid Dr. Mayon's troubles largely to the care of the animals which were being tested. Then Dr. Mayon took up the question of race mixture producing monsters, and he gave some pretty good cases when you look at some types of dogs that we see today. But he said that it might also apply to humans. For instance, he said that a mixture of the tiny Lapp with the big Swede might result in an individual with the huge form of the Swede and the tiny heart and lungs of the Lapp. And again, Castle, following the same line of reasoning, shows that such organs as heart and liver and lungs are not inherited independent of body size. Well, about the time you get pretty well saturated with this sort of argument, along comes another special pleader on the other side and tells us that race mixture means hybrid vigor, and that all of the great people of all times have been rich, the mixed races. Well, what can we believe if the specialists are so uncertain? Perhaps again, we should define our term. And I'm going to, for the discussion of the next 2 or 3 minutes, define race as a division of mankind made up of groups of people who have in common certain physical characteristics. Characteristics so definite that they mark these people off from all other groups of mankind. Now, if you use such a definition, is race a fact? And I think it is. You can stand on the corner of a busy street in one of our large cities and watch the people going by, and you don't need to be an anthropologist, you don't need to be a geneticist to know that people are different. One man passes you, and you know by the color of his skin and the shape of his nose and the thickness of his lips and the character of his hair, you say, well, it was, but this man is a Negro. Another man passes, and you know by the color of his skin and the width of his cheeks and the slant of the eye and the character of his hair and other well-defined characteristics, that you are dealing with a mongoloid. And still another passes, and by his size, the shape of his head, and the light complexion, the blue eyes, the sharp nose, thin lips, you say, well, this man is a Caucasian, but he not only is a Caucasian, but he is a Northern European, probably a Nordic. And another passes, and by the shape of his head, and the darker coloration, you say, well, he is an alpine, and so you might go on. But I want to make this clear, that in defining race in this way, you are never safe in using a single character or 2 or 3 characters. The anthropologist, the physical anthropologist, would use some 30 traits. And on the basis of these 30 traits, he is able to separate mankind out into 3 great divisions, major divisions. Now, I do not mean to say that these are so sharp that there is no line of intermixture. There's race mixture is very old, it's very thorough. There isn't any such thing as a pure race anyway. But there is a big balance if you use a large number of traits by which you can segregate this group and say you have here a division which you call A, and another division you can put here. Or let's say it is as though you spread all mankind out here on a table in front of us. And on the basis of a certain number of characters, you push this group over and say, we'll call this group A, we'll push this group over here and call them group B, we'll call this group over here C, or you can do as the anthropologist does and call them Caucasoid, Negroid, and Mongoloid. And the moment that you have done this, you can subdivide each one of these groups again and subdivide until you get down practically to the individual family. Now, the fact that you can recognize differences in individuals does not mean that you have solved problems. All you have done is to set a problem. This is a problem in genetics. It is, these traits doubtly have genetic basis, but we can't go into that tonight. What I want to say is that these differences are great enough so that you can definitely pick out many individuals and say a great deal about their ancestry. For instance, a group of us at the University of Chicago put out a book, which some of you may be familiar with, called The Nature of the World and of Man. In that, I had a section dealing with race and criteria of race. The book at that time was selling for $6.50, and just why a farmer out in Montana would have bought the book in the first place, I don't know, or why he should pay $6.50 for it. But at any rate, at least one did. And a little while after the book appeared, I had a letter from this gentleman saying that he had read The Nature of the World and of Man with great interest, and he had been particularly interested in the section on race. A few days before, they had been digging a hole out in the yard to bury a horse, and they had come across a skeleton. And he had placed it on the kitchen table and had compared it bit by bit with the description of racial criteria in this book. And he says, "I think I have." And then he went on and detailed what he thought he had. "But I'd like to be sure, so I'm sending the fellow to you by parcel post." And directly the fellow arrived, and the Montana farmer was 100% correct. Now, it is not always that easy. But in spite of the fact that there are differences between people which we label Negro or Mongoloid or whatever you wish, we always magnify the differences. The similarities between all existing human beings are much greater than all of the differences. Organ for organ, bone for bone, we are very similar to each other. We are so close to each other physically that a surgeon here in Urbana who had never operated on anything but Swedes could tonight operate on a pygmy from Africa with the assurance that every organ would lie in approximately the same place. Organ for organ, bone for bone, we are very similar. All existing groups of mankind freely interbreed, the offspring are fertile. By any test, we are very close together. Well, a little different tack. In the middle of the last century, a political party came into existence in the United States known as the Know-Nothings. Their chief plank was to hold citizenship, the only citizens of the United States were to be native-born Protestants. What they were particularly after was the influx of Irish, coming in at that time in very great numbers. Conditions were very hard in Ireland at that time, and the Irish were coming in very large numbers. They were poor, they were uneducated, they took the very poorest jobs that were offered, and they lived together under conditions that were extremely bad. If sometime you're interested in the subject, I would suggest that you read the congressional record of just before the Civil War and read the discussions in the Congress of the United States on Irish immigration. If anything has ever been said about an inferior people, it was said about the Irish. But they came, they stayed, and now look, they're running our cities. In the 1900s, or about 1920s, there was a revival of the Ku Klux Klan, and it swept over the country, and it swept over the Middle West, and it swept over Illinois. In many of our cities, through this state, respectable citizens put on white 90s and burned fiery crosses. Why? To put the Negro, the Catholic, and the immigrant in his place. Now here, race, religion, and length of residence were used to stir up prejudice and distrust. Human slavery was largely based on ideas of inferiority, and that is still used to justify our treatment of many peoples. For instance, I'm frequently asked, "Well, why is it, if the Negro has any ability, why has he never achieved? With all the opportunities given here in America, why has the Negro never achieved?" My answer, usually, is a question. What do you know about the great Negro states of Ashanti and Dahomey? What do you know of what the Negro had accomplished prior to the slave days on this continent? And as a rule, I find out they don't know anything about these people. Another point. When the Negro was brought to this country on the slave trade, they were brought into the islands to the south. They were separated as far as possible so that large groups from any one community would not be together and thus be likely to raise trouble. They were scattered over the plantations and given the most menial type of labor. Very few indeed had any opportunity for education. Very few had anything that could be called property. Then came the Civil War, and these people who had been scattered and broken were turned loose. They were freed, without education, without property, and facing a wall of hate brought on by the Civil War. And yet, in spite of all of these disabilities, I think if you will answer the question frankly, or carry on an investigation of your own, I think you will be compelled to say that in physical well-being, in education, in property, that the American Negro in the last 75 years has achieved more than any other people in the history of the world. That does not mean that many of the Negroes are still poor and uneducated. It does not mean that many of them are coming up from the South with very little background. But it does mean that this people, in spite of all of the hindrances, and the Negro who achieves has gone over barriers we don't know anything about, but the Negro who has achieved has accomplished almost miracles. And yet, in spite of all of these disabilities, he has probably moved faster and accomplished more than any other people in the world's history in a 75-year period. And perhaps at this point, it would be worth our while to think for a moment at least about what some of the people thought about our own ancestors. Because after all, our own ancestors, at least those of us whose ancestry goes back to Northern Europe, our ancestors were pretty backward. The Romans had some very unpleasant things to say about the people of Northern Europe. Do you recall the letter that Cicero wrote to Atticus, in which he says, "Do not get your slaves from Britain. They are so dumb, so utterly incapable of being taught, that they are not fit to grace the household of Athens." In our own experience, among peoples of Asia, in districts where they were not very much used to white people, they would frequently tell us, and we were on friendly terms with them, but they would tell us that white men smelt like goats. We talk about odors, we don't notice our own. When we would move into a town which was not accustomed to white men, all of the natives of the town would come in, and they would squat on the floor in front of us, and they would look at our white skin, they would look at our noses, they would feel of their own noses, and when they couldn't stand it any longer, they'd put their hands up in front of their faces and laugh. In many of the wild towns of northern Luzon, when I would go down to the river to take a swim, the whole town would come down to see me swim, and when I'd come out, they all wanted to feel of my skin to be sure that it was really white, and I'd have to take another bath. Well, this was, it was just unbelievable. We looked down upon, or ridicule, or fear, people who are different, people who are different in physical type, and we also looked down on them for other reasons. We look down upon people who are on lower economic status. We say, we, I won't accuse any individuals. A series of studies, so-called background studies, that have been made by various universities, included one made by Professor Lloyd Warner on what is known as Yankee City, which is one of our New England towns, Newburyport to be exact. Warner took the city from the time of its origin, when the people settled along the coast, perfectly good New Englanders settled along the coast and began to indulge in the whaling trade. And they were pretty successful. And as they accumulated, they moved back a little bit from the coast and built better houses. And the Irish came in and settled along the coast and took over the menial jobs. And they were the so-called scum. They were down below. But they began to do pretty well. And they began to move in. And the early Yankees moved a little further back. And the Irish took over this second zone. And other people came in and did the menial jobs. Now, this record of Newburyport goes from the foundation of the town up to the time of the publication of this book in 10-year periods. And on the basis of what happened there, you could predict what was going to happen to any group that came down along that coast. There were a great many things said about these poor, inferior people that came in to do the menial jobs. Well, to many of us, at least many newcomers are inferior. But if they're not too different, and if they achieve, then we may change our ideas, as we have changed our ideas in regard to the Irish. Well, prejudice is not confined by any means to physical type. In primitive societies, in general, custom and law and religion are pretty much the same thing. It's very difficult to draw the line and say this is where custom and religion and law differ. And if you differ from your fellows, if you do not carry out the customary acts, you outrage the religious feelings in some way. You show disrespect for the ancestors. And so outsiders who come in with different customs are either subjected to derision or looked upon with fear. Now in our own society, with many more contacts, we are less prone. And yet, we ridicule or we fear those who have very different political or religious ideas. It's pretty hard for us to understand how anyone could be a Mohammedan or a Buddhist. How could people join the House of David and the men grow whiskers? When we came home from one trip to the Malay States, I was giving some public lectures, and I threw on the screen some large pictures showing Malay girls with their fingernails and their toenails painted red, and the crowd howled with laughter and knowledge. We are prejudiced. We're prejudiced against people who are different. And this is due in part to distance or to strangeness. It's due in part to difference in physical type. And it's due in part to ignorance and perhaps even more to propaganda. I don't think we begin to realize the extent to which we are subjected to propaganda. And one of the things I would like to suggest that in your reading, that you watch through the succeeding weeks to see how much of the material that comes through the press and that comes through the magazines and the books are evidently tinged. Also, of many scientific, semi-scientific books or articles, such as I have mentioned, and particularly, one of the things which perhaps is the most disastrous towards goodwill is the so-called good story, which carries a sting. The elements in this country, I believe, are all here for another Ku Klux Klan. Well, is there any solution? Yes, I think so. In the first place, the child has no race prejudice. The child has very few prejudices. The child, all of us, are largely conditioned, and a large part of prejudice is inculcated in the home before the school ever gets a chance. A great deal can be done after the children reach the school age, but it seems clear that the parents and the people in the homes must act with great care if they wish to weed out intolerance and prejudice among the younger generation. Another point which I think is very necessary for those of us as adults is to get the facts, to learn the facts of race, and to learn facts about other peoples. In America, we have a great number of peoples, peoples with very different backgrounds. Some of them are native peoples, some are those who have come to us. An attempt is being made in many institutions to carry on these so-called background studies, leading to a better understanding of peoples. You have an example of it in your own university and in this department in Professor Lewis' new book on Mexico, which is just off the press and which I saw for the first time this afternoon. These background studies, these attempts to understand other people, at least in part, will help to relieve the tension. We must try to know and to understand something of the Negro past. We should attempt to know and understand the Mexican and the Sicilian, because it is through knowledge and goodwill, that understanding and tolerance will come about. I see I've talked an hour. I haven't said a great deal, but I do thank you for coming and listening when you didn't have to. Thank you.
I know from having been a student under Professor Kroll at Chicago that he is perfectly willing to let you impose on his time further. If you have any specific questions that you would like to raise with him, I'm sure you'll be glad to try and answer them.
Yes?
The various points you discussed, which do you think anyone, the major ones in the Negro problem,
I didn't quite get your question.
Do you think that one cause is, what do you think the major causes of the spectrum of the Negro in the country, in the North?
Well, I think that is very clear. The Negro was brought to this country very largely under the plea that he was an inferior person to do an inferior job. He was kept in subjection, and while he was in the South and in not very much in the North, there was a strong feeling that brought about the freedom of the Negroes. But as Negro populations pushed north to solve labor problems, there was opposition from certain of the laborers, fear of an influx. Also was the fact that many of the Negroes, when they first came in, were people who had very little background, who had come without education, were willing to take jobs at very low prices. I think all of this helped to build up prejudice against the Negro, in addition to the fact that he differed rather more radically from the rest of the population. There are many causes. There's no single cause. Again, I think it becomes very largely a question as to when a people begin to achieve, when they get certain status, then your attitude begins to change toward them. But I think that a great deal of the prejudice was directly harkened back to a long period of Negro slavery. There probably are some. There are many more, I think, were taken in. There are a good many so-called scientific or semi-scientific writers whose articles look pretty plausible and whose articles are published perhaps as part of information. I think that I don't think that any of us would deny, we could think of certain newspapers that definitely color their news and carry on propaganda. And I think part of it's on the racial basis. But not all of it, by any means. A lot of people are taken in. Yeah?
You referred to the great similarity between people. And I was wondering how you accounted for educators believing that there is tremendous individual differences between those same people. Could you clarify that?
The point I wanted to make, first of all, was that in spite of the manifest differences, color of skin, and so on, that physically, bone for bone, organ for organ, we're very much alike. The same thing is true if you begin to study the brain. The brain is very much alike. And I think that you will find many fewer educators today who would say that there are the differences between the races that would many fewer than there were some years back. Oftentimes, the educational tests have been set up on the basis of the knowledge and education of the group which the tester is familiar with. Whereas, if he had used the testing of the other group, he might have found that they would have stood equally high. There was a Chinese professor over in this country a few years ago who was very much interested in some of the psychological tests. And he said that he would like to set up a series of psychological tests and administer them based on Chinese ideas and administer them to the faculty of the University of Chicago. He thought he could show we were subnormal. Yes.
Yes. I have a happens to come from that part of the world. And I would like to ask, the mentality of these people, particularly the Ikugaos.
You'd like to ask what?
The Ikugaos, their mentality.
Well, there's nothing wrong with them at all. they have a background, a tradition, which not only makes headhunting respectable, but it was necessary. A long series of teachings indicated that in order to have crops mature at the proper time, that a headhunt was necessary. Certain religious ceremonies demanded the sacrifice of a human being. And this is carried on through belief, tradition, and religion. A man gains prestige by the number of lives to his credit. The young man stands a much better chance with the girls if he is known as a successful headhunter. All of these things put a prestige on headhunting, which makes it respectable. But so far as the mentality is concerned, there's nothing wrong. I brought a boy from the Tingyan group in the inner territory of Abra over to this country on one week, learning from the Philippines. The boy had perhaps the equivalent of a third-grade education. Not all in school, by any means. He had been on the Vigan on the coast for a little while, and he picked up a little Spanish, he picked up a little English. But he came, he had perhaps the equivalent of a third-grade education. He stayed with us. We were home 10 months on that trip, and he stayed with us and around the film museum and learned a good deal more. At the end of that period, he wanted to stay in this country, and I sent him to school for 2 years in Ames, where there were a number of the Ilocano boys with whom he could talk. At the end of that period, we sent him to Ames. And in the next 3 years, where he had to compete at least with high school graduates, in the next 3 years, he had a record better than 85, except in two studies, one of which was English. Now, there wasn't anything wrong with that, the gray matter and that stuff. It's just a part of the traditional background and not anything that is wrong at all with the brain. Some of the keenest men that I have known have been pagans in various parts of the world. Some of them were in the Philippines, some of them were in Borneo, and some of them were in other parts of that part of the world.
You mentioned before one of the chief methods of combating prejudices is in the preschooling days of our population, pre-elementary schooling days. And I think I certainly agree with that. And there are certainly, if one parent to combat prejudice among this young group, you have to teach them.
That's right.
And I'm just wondering now on the possibilities of taking advantage of modern means of communication and television, especially after having seen what I see of seeing the television. There isn't much teaching in there of wiping out prejudice among parents themselves. Are there any steps or any possibilities steps to be taken? The university here, one television station, commercial people fighting them and change the world.
Well, I think there's a chance, but I think that to people like those of us gathered here tonight have got to demand of the radio and of the television and of the publishers that the programs built towards tolerance or towards understanding be presented. I think that the radio and television and others, once they become convinced that a certain type of program is wanted, will certainly follow the demand. But one of our tasks seems to be to try to raise the standard of material. A lot is being done. If you listen to the radio, I think with that in mind, you'd be surprised to see how many programs there are making towards tolerance. There are a great many movements on hand. And bad as conditions are, bad as the situation was in Cicero a few weeks ago, still we make progress.